we just have this one gospel reading. Lent is a time for discipline, and now I call upon your best efforts to listen to a long passage, but important as we enter Holy Week. Then the whole assembly rose and led Jesus off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee, he's come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." With one voice, they cried out, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us." Barabbas had been thrown in prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time, he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I'll have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others, let him save himself, if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." There was a written notice above him which read, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence. We are punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, "Surely this was a righteous man." When all the people who had gathered to witness this sight saw what took place, they beat their breasts and went away. But all those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. May God bless the reading of Holy Scripture. We'll come back to that lengthy reading in just a moment. Before I do that, I want to say a quick word about this handout that was an insert in your bulletin. If you were here last week, you got this questionnaire without the red wording part of it. So the task was to take these different words, the top 10 words for sin, the bottom 10 words for salvation, and put them in order, rank them 1 to 10. And so what you have, the survey results are in red. And I thought some of you want to know how it came out, how your answers may have corresponded to others, and you may not remember exactly how you ranked these, but the idea was which of these terms resonate with you, which ones make sense to you, and which ones would you never find yourself using, just not part of the way you talk or the way you understand how God has loved us in Jesus Christ. So you see there the top 10. These are words that the Bible uses to describe how sin distorts our lives. And I mentioned in an email I sent this week, the bottom line of the survey you can take home is this. You all are pretty good Lutherans as Presbyterians and not very good Greek Orthodox Christians, okay? So the words that wound up at the top of both these lists are a very Protestant, very Lutheran, sort of European 16th century words. And the words that you tended not to resonate with at the bottom of both lists are words that are at the very heart of all Eastern Orthodox traditions of Christianity. So if you remember, the Protestant-Catholic split in the 16th century is not the only split there was. In 1054, in the middle of the 11th century, the East split from the West. So Constantinople, now Istanbul, in the East was that center of power, and Rome in the West. So I'm talking about all those churches in the Eastern tradition, right? So I suppose this wasn't all that surprising to me. On the top list, those first six words, guilt and shame and impurity, I would put all in a camp. Those are psychological words that we might use in the normal course of life. 2, 4, and 6, brokenness, estrangement, alienation, you might put them in a basket. Those are all relationship words, damaged relationships. So those made sense to lots of us. What made less sense was number 7, oppression. Maybe a more political word. Interesting that it's down that far. That's probably the central term in the Exodus story, right? The second book of the Bible, which carries all throughout the Old Testament, and which Jesus picks up in Luke 4 to announce his own ministry. "I've come to announce release, liberation for the captives." So ignorance, we read about that today. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them. They do not know what they're doing. They're ignorant." Damnation, number 9. That's used, you can look at 2 Thessalonians 1:9, but that's not a big word for us. And mortality. Again, in the Eastern tradition, mortality is one way to describe the problem that God's dealing with. Down at the bottom 10, again, a Lutheran list, forgiveness. All through the book of Romans talks about forgiveness, bestowal of new life. You might think about John 3, Nicodemus asks, how can we be born again? So that new birth language, new creation language in 2 Corinthians 5. Reconciliation, that's a relationship term. A relationship that's gone bad is mended. Again, that's 2 Corinthians 5. Liberation, freedom language for our salvation. That's Exodus and Luke 4, like I already mentioned. The sacrifice language was sort of in the middle for us. We happen not to be Jewish followers of Jesus, but most of the writers in the New Testament were. So this sacrifice language was important to them in Hebrews and Revelation. In 1 Corinthians 5, the Apostle Paul refers to Jesus as our Passover lamb. So that language made lots of sense if you were Jewish. Acquittal language, that's sort of technical courtroom language for forgiveness, all through Romans. Illumination, this is a word. Now we're getting into Greek Orthodox Christianity, a huge word for them, illumination. Think about John's Gospel, how it begins. Jesus is the light who comes into the world. Sanctification, idea that the Holy Spirit is given to us to make us holy. Friendship was number 9. This is interesting to me because that's probably my favorite. That word would have been at the top of my list. That comes from John's Gospel again, chapter 15, when Jesus says to his followers, "I no longer refer to you as slaves, but friends." So this idea that we are not God's enemies, we are God's friends. This last one may have raised your eyebrows. Deification, or another fancy word for it sometimes, is divinization. Same thing. So the meaning of that term is to become as godlike as it's possible for a creature to become. And so this would be the primary word in Eastern Orthodox traditions for the process of salvation. What God's doing is to make you as godlike as it's possible for a creature like you to become. And you can, if that sounds really strange to you or unbiblical, you can look at 2 Peter 1:4 later. Okay, that's all I was going to say about that. Questions, comments, surprises, anything you want to register about those lists of words? Really, what these questionnaires were meant to get to the last couple of weeks is just the richness of the array of the way that Scripture describes the good news of God's love and salvation. It is much too rich and beautiful to be put in any one term or image or metaphor. So the Bible uses all sorts of different poetic language to describe what it's like to experience God's love for us. And it's good that we have this much language for it because we might need different parts of it at different times in our lives. Okay, now let's turn back to our gospel reading from Luke today. The Innocence Project is a legal organization that uses DNA testing. They do that in the hope of exonerating people who have been wrongly convicted of a crime. Since the beginning of this Innocence Project in 1992, 350 people have been exonerated of the crime they were convicted for and released from prison. So it has been wildly successful beyond even the dreams of the lawyers who founded the project in 1992. One of the people exonerated last month was a man named Archie Williams. Archie served 36 years in the Louisiana State Penitentiary for assaulting an elderly woman. Fingerprints at the crime scene did not match those of Archie Williams. But the victim of this crime, who happened to be the wife of a prominent citizen in Baton Rouge, identified Mr. Williams as her attacker in court. He was convicted by a jury, in spite of the fact that the fingerprints at the scene did not match his. But now, because of advances in fingerprint technology and advances in databases, and because of the work of the lawyers at the Innocence Project, the case was retried just last month. The fingerprints at the scene were found to match those of a serial rapist in that area who went on to commit other crimes before finally being arrested. Archie Williams was 22 when he was arrested and falsely convicted. He is 58 years old now, finally exonerated of a crime he didn't commit and now released from prison. Mr. Williams said he bore no grudge against the victim for wrongly identifying him at the trial 36 years ago. He said, "All that's behind us now, and I just want to enjoy my freedom." Knowing that innocent people are sometimes convicted and sentenced might help us hear Luke's story of Jesus' death on the cross. When Jesus died, Luke tells us that all those acquainted with him stood at a distance, watching these things. So do you, and so do I. We're watching too. And watching, we're not sure whether to run and hide so that this doesn't happen to us, or whether to run to his tortured body to take it down from that cruel device of torture. So as you listen to this story, as it dances through your heart, as you imagine its force, what are you seeing? Which parts of this telling grab you? Which characters in the story came to life for you? Which lines of dialogue, which details were sharpest as you heard them? You may have noticed the crowds full of hate, whipped into a frenzy like crowds can get. You may have noticed two cowardly politicians handing Jesus back and forth as they try to appease the crowds. You may have noticed Simon, just a bystander, who was pulled into the story and forced to carry Jesus' cross. You may have noticed the two criminals who were crucified on Jesus' right and left. You may have noticed the sky that went dark and hazy, that strange midday dusk that envelops us as this working class Jewish man hangs from a cross, breathing his last. You may have noticed Jesus' final words in Luke's telling as he pushes himself up one last time with a weary groan, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." You may have noticed a few women and men not quite ready to leave the scene, staying, watching, grieving, wondering. We are among them. Jesus said to all that would listen that God's new world of love was drawing near to all of us in his own life. But now look, he's gotten himself killed by those who are invested in keeping everything just the same. And in the midst of all these details, you may have noticed Luke's picture of Jesus as the innocent one who was killed in place of others. Perhaps we can imagine ourselves as Barabbas, the murderer who is released and freed from a death sentence as Jesus takes his place. Three different times in this telling, Pontius Pilate testifies to the innocence of Jesus. "I find no basis for a charge against this man," he says. Herod and his soldiers, they make fun of Jesus. They dress him up as a king. But Herod neither finds a basis for a charge against him. One thief on the cross says to the other, "Don't you know that this man has done nothing wrong?" Finally, the Roman soldier, the centurion stationed by the cross, says when he witnesses Jesus' last breath, "Surely this was a righteous man." It's hard for us to imagine an innocent life, a life that never bends to the distorting forces that shape our lives. What would it be like to have never harmed another person? What would it be like never to have betrayed someone? Never to live beneath what you're capable of? Never to miss an opportunity in life to heal or to bless or to encourage another person who needs something? What would it be like to love God and your neighbor with all your heart and soul and mind and strength? What would it be like to live in unflinching fidelity to God's new kingdom of love, even in the face of threat? I don't know, because I've never lived that way. But Jesus did. He was and is God's faithful covenant partner, whose life now includes yours and mine. This is a dark story for a dark day on the Lenten calendar. Today is Palm Sunday, also called Passion Sunday. It marks both our joy, our festivity at receiving Jesus into Jerusalem during that final week. But what we're only beginning to understand is that his arrival is always the arrival of suffering love. What we're only beginning to understand is that God's great love for us is large enough to hold all that fails, all that goes dark, all that doesn't work, all the harms that we inflict and all the harms we suffer. Anyone can keep their chin up when things are going well. What we need is good news that can hold all the pain and failure that we experience in the course of a lifetime. We are not innocent, but he is. And now we have our lives in him. Thanks be to God.